Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Google's new $400 Pixel 3a has a Pixel camera and a headphone jack. Google smart home products are all Nest now. Nova's IdeaPad S940 reviewed. And hey, Microsoft Power Toys has gone open source. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 516, recorded on May 9th, 2019. The Pixel 3a, 3.5 millimeters of headphone heaven. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to reimage unlimited computer models from one golden image. Search their library for your models and get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/twitch. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it is that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1 year package, go to expressvpn.com/twitch. And by Helm. Take back your email, files, and photos and own your data with Helm, a secure personal server that enables you to own your online identity. Go to the helm.com/twitch to save $50 off the Helm personal server. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, a Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you all the excitement in hardware news. Desktops, laptops, mobile, consoles, weird little stuff that gets scattered around your house. We are down for it. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Sebastian Peek of PC Purr. Welcome back, Sebastian.
That's good to be back, Patrick. How are you doing?
I'm full of mirth and good cheer and shock and joy at what I will affectionately call the return of the Nexus series to Google.
That can only be good news.
Yeah, Google I.O. took place this week. Something that was anticipated, but of course not real until it was actually announced, the Google Pixel 3a. Essentially, the story on this is you got a $400 Pixel camera. Oh, well, a $400 phone that includes a Pixel camera. Mostly, 1080p OLED display, small bezel. Actually, not a little bigger than 1080p. Let me just walk through this. OLED display, small bezels, polycarbonate body, and I'm okay with plastic bodies because they break less and they bend less. A mid-level processor, a Qualcomm Snapdragon 670 running at 2 gigahertz, Adreno 615 graphics. This bothers some phone reviewers a lot because they're like, I want the latest Snapdragon 800 series. And the reality is for most of us, apps may launch a little slower and some apps may run a little slower, but for most people, that Snapdragon 670 is more than enough power. They're claiming with their 3,000 milliamp hour battery, Google says the standard 3A is going to get 30 hours of general use. They've got 18 watt fast charging, and they're saying 7 hours of battery life with 15 minutes of charging. The 3A, the standard one, packs a 5.6 inch panel, 2,220 by 1,080 pixels. That's 441 pixels per inch. The 3A XL, that's the 6-inch version, is 2160 by 1080, or a hair smaller in one direction, at least according to the numbers I saw. For that 0.4-inch larger screen, you're going to pay an extra $80, but you also get a 3,700 milliamp hour battery, which I presume is to help power the bigger screen. No wireless charging. There's no water resistance claims. There's no IP rating. I like waterproof phones, but Google's just like, no. 64 gigabytes only with no micro SD expansion, which really bums me out because I like having billions of hours of music stored locally on my phone instead of streaming it. Just about everybody but AT&T is going to be selling them, but an unlocked Pixel 3a will work fine on AT&T. The camera is kind of the really big story on this. 12.2 megapixel rear camera with optical and electronic image stabilization. That's a f1.8 aperture on that one. So basically, you've got something that's right there in the neighborhood of the low light performance of the full size camera. The front camera, 8 megapixel with f2 aperture. Dieter Bohn at The Verge pretty much sums up the camera. I like how he put it. Quote, in 15 years of reviewing phones, I'm not sure if I have ever been able to write the following sentence. A $400 phone has a camera that's among the best you can get on any smartphone. And for a lot of people, this is and myself included, this is a big deal. Dieter calls it, Mr. Bohn over at The Verge calls it, the phone to buy between $300 and $500. And, you know, it's probably the phone to buy if you're looking at a $300 phone, if you really, really care about image quality for pictures. This is not a premium phone. You know, like my beloved and beat on, you know, Motorola G6, there's a lot of plastic because plastic's inexpensive and plastic's fairly tough. And you're also paying a half or a third of much as of the price of a premium phone, except that you're getting a flagship phone. You know, and the camera is just as good as a flagship phone. I really feel like this is the return of the Nexus lineup and that Google's going, hey, we should, you know, take some of this amazing camera goodness and put it in a price bracket where more people can afford it.
Yeah, I was a huge Nexus fan. Nexus 4 is what actually got me off of an iPhone back when that came out. And I was on a Nexus 5 and then had a Nexus 5X, Nexus 6. Never got the 6P, which ended up kind of being a blessing because of all the issues with those long term, but it was kind of sad to see the line go away. The Pixel was a very good phone, the first generation Pixel, and of course, just a legendary camera. And it seems like every iteration of Pixel has been just improving on that. If you look at like DxOMark scores and just the ridiculous low light performance. One of the things about this camera is I'm looking at the specs. Yeah, it's 12.2 megapixels. Megapixels aren't everything. And we've seen outrageous numbers. Yeah, we've seen like 40 plus megapixels on a phone. But unless you have like the larger pixel size, then you're not getting better. Like the larger sensors with larger pixels, like, you know, two micron pixels would be great. Right. This is 1.4, which is still pretty good. And there's a lot of phones out there with like 1 to 1.2 pixel size. And
well,
so
bigger is context.
Better.
Right. And I was just about to say the smaller the pixel size on the sensor for the camera, the worse the low light performance is. The bigger the pixel size on the sensor of the camera, the better the low light performance is. So, yeah, it would be nice to see even bigger pixels on there. But to sort of augment what you're saying is, you know, megapixels are kind of worthless. Oh, it's 16 megapixel. Well, if they don't have really, really good processing, if they don't have a really, really good lens, if it's not a particularly high quality sensor, you know, it's like, well, you know, I got a 440 cubic inch engine, but I have a restrictor plate on it and it's geared improperly. And, you know, I have, you know, it's just, it's not, you know, the sensor is a huge part of it, but if you don't have a very, very good sensor and very, very good processing behind the sensor, then there's no point in going for, you know, super megapixels. So I'm with you on that. A bunch more was announced at Google I/O, but I wanted to talk about a couple other announcements that came up in the phone arena, if you will. First up, Samsung says they have no anticipated shipping date for the Galaxy Fold.
This does not surprise me at all. I don't know about you, but I was down on this when we talked about this before, but the product, when it was released to reviewers early, had major glaring design problems. Not the kind of design problems that you can just, you know, patch up and still hit your release target. And I think this is, if I'm going to be really negative, my prediction would be that this is never released. If a folding phone from Samsung is released, it will be a completely different design because it has to be.
Yeah.
There were just too many gaps in this thing. It was too easy to lift and basically destroy the screen in normal use for this to be a viable product that they can release to the public.
Yeah. When crud gets in one of the giant holes in the side of the phone and then automatically creates, you know, holes or dents or pockets or other problematic issues. I mean, yeah, it's frustrating because I'm like, did they not do any field testing with these? Did they just test these in a lab? Did they not give them to normal people? You know, and Samsung's US arm, you know, the quote that in that Reuters article, if we do not hear from you and have not shipped by May 31st, your order will be canceled automatically. And that's, you know, that's a normal U.S. regulation. It's like to notify customers if pre-orders aren't going to happen. You know, this was not going to be a high volume product for Samsung. Samsung makes like 300 million phones a year. This was supposed to be maybe 1 million, according to the Reuters article, which is a lot of phones to me, but that's 1/300th of Samsung's output. You know, they also claimed that was kind of a cruel note in that article, is that Samsung stopped Galaxy Fold pre-orders due to high demand. Because they realized they were going to have a problem. Android Q is getting over-the-air security updates. Sounds amazing, except there's just two little problems. You know, one of the things I truly love about the iPhone compared to the Android environment or the iOS environment is that, when Steve Jobs negotiated the deals with the carriers, part of that was to be able to do, to upload code to repair the phone, to update the phone, to fix the phone, whatever, directly from Apple servers. And of course, in Android land, it goes from, Google or Android to the manufacturer, to the carrier, and eventually it might even get to you if it even makes it to your carrier, makes it to the manufacturer. And so the idea here is, like, you're not going to have to wait for security updates if you have a Q device, except, as that was noted in that TechCrunch article, people updating to Q, i.e., if you didn't buy a phone with Q on it from the factory, you are not going to get the over-the-air security updates. And manufacturers, or at least some manufacturers, can opt out altogether. So that's what I like to call unfortunate. And it's also interesting when you realize, when you look at the Android developers distribution dashboard, I want to say like 10% is on Pi. 28% is on Oreo. Another 19-20% is on Nougat, Marshmallow. So, it's the majority of users are still on 8.1 or earlier. I'd probably say between KitKat and Oreo. So it's not like a lot of us are going to get Q updates anytime soon. And if you do, you will be probably... Well, if you don't buy a phone new, you're not going to get over-the-air updates to Q. So, does it bother you at all the lag time between Android updates and when they make it through to your actual device?
It does bother me. That's why when I switched to Android, I waited until I could get a Nexus device, and that was my primary concern coming from an iPhone, which I'd been using since 2007, which was my first bona fide smartphone. I was so spoiled to, as soon as Apple released an update, I could connect my phone to iTunes and download it and have it that day. And I had the same essential experience with the Nexus, and I was downloading factory images and doing things myself. So to go to a phone that doesn't have that kind of direct line to updates day one is, even as Windows users now, we're used to our laptops wanting to restart all the time for every update that comes down the pipe.
Take it too far.
Yeah. And our phones might be running an October 2018 security version. So,
or 16.
I want the latest updates on my phone, but on the other hand, I also like a bit of control. It was nice to be able to take my phone to the computer and flash it with a factory image, but I'm strange. I'm the person who's willing to blow away my phone and start over again every week. So, over-the-air updates are a great alternative to people. And if Google's really going to be able to bypass carriers, which seems odd to me, I feel like Verizon will somehow have a problem with this and it won't actually go straight to user devices, but we'll see.
But Verizon loves us. They have nothing.
They do, but they also love validating things for, 4 months.
Yeah, no, I have felt that pain. Oh, you can't use the micro SD cards you have? Well, that's been patched. You'll have to wait till your carrier finishes. And I just remember being like, okay, so this is a previous generation phone. And there was, a 10-week lag time between when I found out about the patch. And the patch was fairly old at that point. And it was another 10 weeks or so before I was actually able to get the update onto my phone. Maddening. Crazed. Foolish. What's not maddening, people, is making your life easier if you're in an IT department. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to re-image unlimited computer models Think about that. Unlimited computer models from one golden image. They offer one-click user data migration for simplified migration, zero-touch network deployment, imaging over the internet, and application deployment to make your project stress-free. They don't care how big you are, 50 users, 50,000 computers at your company. Their device driver injection technology combined with technician-built driver packages called platform packs are going to make your life easier. Over 1,200 platform packs include Lenovo, HP, and Dell, all of the major OEMs. If you have a new model, you just download the pack and deploy your golden image to any business class computer. Smart Deploy is the most reliable, easy-to-use solution that has been trusted to deploy over 2.2 million endpoints. Imaging over Wi-Fi, you can deploy images, apps, and updated drivers to your endpoint. You can use Dropbox, you can use Google Drive, OneDrive, OneDrive for Business. They don't care. They are open to options. Step-by-step wizards will guide you through the process, and complicated steps like sysprep are handled for you automatically. No ramp-up, no training necessary. Migrate 100 computers to Windows 10 in under an hour with out-of-the-box multicast support. The support team, based in Seattle, made up of imaging and Windows experts, they are just an email or a phone call away. Companies like Nintendo, UCLA, and Nissan turned to Smart Deploy to make the dreaded task of computer imaging a bit less painful. That means you aren't going to be doing the beta for this product because some other big companies have already tested it out and found it successful. And right now, Smart Deploy has given our audience 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/twitch. If you work at a company with 50 to 50,000 computers, head to smartdeploy.com/twitch to get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. And we want to thank Smart Deploy for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. So the other kind of dog pile of announcements yesterday or earlier this week was around the big one, literally, was the Google Nest Hub Max. So Google made a bigger Google Home Hub, and they renamed the Google Home Hub the Nest Hub. The Nest Hub, by the way, is now $129. The big one, the Max, is $229. And it, look, kids, it gets a Nest camera and a couple of microphones. And the other announcement, so we've watched the sort of back and forth between Nest and Google. All Google smart home products will be Nest moving forward. And my caveat on that is until Google decides to name them something else. So it was, if you have been looking for a bigger, better, shinier Google Home Hub, and for some reason you didn't want to use Lenovo's, which I thought was pretty cool. You have some additional, you have an additional option. I thought it was interesting to watch them start to change the branding again. You know, Lenovo, I think their smart display is pretty slick, which I managed to get into my house for several hours before my wife removed it. My wife being extremely not interested in having listening devices or talking computers in the house. But, you know, it's nice to see something larger, because it always struck me looking at, I want to say like in Costco, the Lenovo smart display, the 10-inch smart display with the Google Assistant was parked right next to the original Google Home Hub. Now the Nest Hub, and you know that Nest / Google Home Hub always looked tiny by comparison, and that screen just needed a little help. The other thing that changed this week, and I was laughing because this came up on Variety of all places, the Works with Nest program is done. So that's part of their sort of integrating of the home automation stuff or the home stuff or the Internet of Things into Google. You'll be able to move your Nest accounts into Google now, which will give you increased security, which I thought was a big deal. There's also a lot of stuff we probably don't need to talk about on a hardware show, but it's interesting to hear how Google has decided to up their privacy game for end users. And if you see some, you know, search for Google I.O. privacy or Google I.O. 2019 and privacy if you're curious about that. But, it's interesting, right? Because it seemed like Nest was going to go away, and now they're fully supporting or fully behind the Nest brand, and it is what it is. So another opportunity to put a device you can talk to in your house. anything? I think I've lost Sebastian.
No, I'm here. I'm just thinking as they continue to get bigger, and obviously they can gain like larger speakers, they become a more viable mm-hmm. solution for listening to music and watching content. At what point do these just become televisions? Like, well, small TVs?
I think at some point they'll start integrating these. I think there must be at least one. I should know this. There should be at least one out there that already has Nest, or not Nest, but Google Assistant built in.
Yeah. I know Sony TVs are all powered by Google, right? They all run on some sort of Android operating system. So that would be a logical progression for them. But I'm not personally aware of a model that's like 100%, like it's got the microphones and the full assistant capabilities and maybe a camera. Not that I really want that, but.
Well, it's funny. There's an entire collection of Google Assistant smart TVs up on Best Buy, which includes Sharp, Vizio, Samsung, and other models. And I'm really kind of curious about that. You know, and of course, you have Google Assistant on Android TV, which is a short list, but certainly an option out there. That's the Sony Bravia, the LG OLED TVs, and of course the NVIDIA Shield that are running Google Assistant on Android TV. So there's options out there. The other the really good interview, and one of the things I like about The Verge is they often have access to some of the bigger players inside the larger tech companies, and they did a whole thing with Rick Osterloh, you know, a big conversation about what was going on with Google and Nest and hardware and phones. And, you know, one of the things that I didn't realize is that this Pixel, a big part of the new Pixel 3a, is it was engineered in large part by the HTC engineers that Google acquired in 2018. And, you know, it's you know, they seem to be getting really, really serious about making money off of hardware and producing more hardware, thus the lower cost phone. And I'm also kind of really curious to see what happens again. You know, I've said it before. It's like, okay, now everything is going to be Nest. You know, Google bought Nest, they spun out Nest, they reorganized Alphabet, they folded Nest back into Google. You know, Nest became part of the Google Home TV or the Google Home group. So, you know, this Google Nest Hub Max, I think, is going to be an interesting experiment to see how well everything kind of works together. And I got to say, another shout out. You know, I like that they're bringing the desktop inside of the Google accounts. One, because it's nice to have it integrated, and two, because I think Google's security is still a lot harder to deal with. That's another article by Dieterbahn up at The Verge. It's definitely worth taking a look at, but it's interesting. In terms of PC Per, or I should actually probably just ask, hey, tweet at Patrick Norton or at Sebastian Peake, do you care about smart home devices? Do you want us to talk more about that? And what kind of stuff would you like to see us cover on This Week in Computer Hardware? I mean, are you guys going to be covering more of this stuff on PC Per, or do you guys feel that the less, the better?
Well, I've thought about adding it as a category, and we've talked internally about it because we have some people on the staff who are enthusiastic about things and have bought things on their own to kind of automate their homes, or, you know, and I think every one of us has something. It's hard if you're into technology in 2019 to not have some kind of connected devices in your house, and then you start to think about how they could all work together and incorporate one of these virtual assistants. So it's become such a relevant and just a ubiquitous category that it makes a lot of sense to cover it. That's more of like the general tech vein, but right. I wouldn't be surprised at all if in the next 6 months to a year, we have somebody on staff who's like, okay, I'm reviewing this stuff, because the companies want the product coverage. They'll send the samples. It's just a matter of, do we have somebody with enough time to create an entirely new category? But it would be interesting. I would just love to see someone's opinion on, you know, the various solutions and how they work and what the software is like, what the phone integration is like. It's just like networking. You know the pain of network testing. I don't have time for networking. I don't have the specialized knowledge, but I want someone else on the staff to do all of the hard work to tell me which router to buy. You know, I'm the consumer at that point.
It's it never ends. It's just everything. It's all miserable. All testing is miserable, and we do it for you, gentle listener or viewer. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by ExpressVPN. Admit it, look, you're either thinking about security, you're not thinking about security. Maybe you travel, maybe you don't. You know, you grab your laptop, you head down to the coffee shop. I don't log into the Wi-Fi at the coffee shop because I don't know who else is on the Wi-Fi in the coffee shop, and I don't particularly want them sniffing my packets. And sure, HTTPS, it's fairly secure, it should lock things down, but they still can kind of figure out where you're going and what you're doing, which is why you should be securing your internet connection with ExpressVPN. Keep your data safe, right? If you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you might as well be just broadcasting the world everything you're doing and what you're doing with. And ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. That's what a VPN does. Maybe you don't like your ISP tracking you. Maybe you're browsing in public. Maybe you're at the airport in Las Vegas. ExpressVPN, they have easy-to-use apps. They run seamlessly in the background. Your computer, your phone, your tablet, they secure your connection to the internet. If you can click a button, you can turn on ExpressVPN and its security. Safely surf on public Wi-Fi. You don't have to worry about being snooped on, having your data stolen, having, you know, them tracking what you're doing. And it's cheap. For less than $7 a month, you can get the same ExpressVPN protection that I've been using. ExpressVPN rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/twitch for 3 extra months free with the 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/twitch to learn more. And we want to thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, my goodness. Laptop season is beginning again.
Yes.
And the latest one I got to review, this one's from Lenovo. We're waiting to see the next generation XPS 13. And this, of course, you know, if you might notice, it's shiny. It's svelte. It's less than a half inch thick. And it feels good in the hand. This is the IdeaPad S940. A lot of people fell in love with this laptop at CES 2019 because it is a really nice laptop. It feels really, really good. The keyboard I thought was a little unusual. The key travel, I feel like the key travel's either shorter. I can't really decide on what's going on, but the keys have a certain distinctive pop or pressure to them. It's very, very different from, say, the regular ThinkPad keyboards. But it feels good. It's easy to type on. The screen, however, is a really, really big deal. You're talking about currently they're not shipping any of the 1080p versions. This is a 500 nit 4K HDR Base of 400 rated screen. They're supposed to release a 1080p Dolby Vision HDR model later this year. And you know, the glass, the Gorilla Glass on the front wraps around the bezel. It's got that notch up at the top, which you can kind of see if you're watching the video. The notch at the top houses the webcam, so you don't have to deal with nostril cam. Nothing's down below on that one. This one was running a Core i7-8565U. It's like a 1.8 gigahertz Core i7 with a 4.6 gigahertz turbo boost, 8 megs of cache. Our model had 16 gigs of RAM and a fat 1 gigabyte PCI NVMe SSD. This is a USB-C only laptop, two USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports along with a regular USB-C. There's a headphone jack. Oh, my goodness. I totally forgot. There's a headphone jack on the Pixel 3a.
Is there?
I just need to tell everybody that. Wow. There's a headphone jack on the Pixel 3a. There's also a headphone jack on the S940.
I'm talking about that afterwards. But yeah, please continue telling us about the laptop. And by the way, can I just say for video listeners, that transition was breathtaking. Have you seen that, Patrick, where it goes to the laptop screen and then folds and then dives off? There we go. Amazing.
Amazing. Props to Kevin. Always making things interesting. I'm going to be, you know, doing some more testing with this. So it's a very thin laptop. you know, it's got heat pipes and a pair of cooling fans moving air out of it. In terms of everyday usage, you know, it's like every Core i5 or Core i7 laptop I've had my hands on in the last 5 years. You know, it works. It's fast. It's great. You know, when I started beating on the S940 by throwing a very large video file into Handbrake, it was a lot slower than I expected it to be compared to like a previous generation Core i7 Dell XPS 13. Like 5.3, 5.6 frames per second compared to the Dell running. I think the Dell ended up running about 8.8 frames per second once the project was about done. In terms of render time, and this, I did a particularly cruel rendering scheme just to make sure it took a long time. But that difference, that doesn't, it's like 3 frames per second or point, 3 frames per second over the course of a 30, 40 minute video is the difference between an hour and 30 and 2 hours and 30 minutes in rendering time. So I've also seen firmware updates speed up machines. I'm kind of curious about the thermals, so I might have some more to talk about it on that next week after going nuts with CPU mon and playing around. Memory is not upgradable. It's soldered to the motherboard, but you can upgrade the storage, which I am always a big fan of. You know, 4 screws on the bottom of the case, pop it loose, and there's a big, easy-to-access space where the NVMe SSD goes. Typing felt good. Trackpad's as good as anything I've used. Keys were good. A pair of front-facing speakers to the left and right of the keyboard, and Dolby Atmos, which is supposed to envelop you in sound, but mostly, you know, sounds a little bit bigger than the laptop. And, you know, the thing I said on Tech Thing was like, you know, if I'm not sharing a YouTube video with people, I'm wearing headphones, because no matter how good the laptop speakers are, my headphones are better because I carry really, really good headphones everywhere I go. 13.9-inch screen, 802.11 AC, 2x2, Bluetooth 5.0, 720p camera, no shutter cover or camera cover, which is something that shows up on most of the ThinkPad models these days. You know, it's nice. It's not inexpensive. You know, starting prices were projected around $1,500 back at CES, but right now they're only shipping the 4K HDR screens, and you're looking at $1,800 to $2,000. So this particular configuration, which is kind of a beast that they're selling up at Best Buy, is around $2,000, maybe a little bit higher because of the size of the drive inside of it. But the 4K systems with the Core i7 processor and 8 gigabytes of RAM are starting at around $1,800. So, you know, they're saying 9 hours of battery life with the 4K screen, 15 hours on the 1080p screen, which gives you an idea of how much juice this screen is sucking down, especially if you max that thing out because you're sitting out in the sunshine. So I'll be doing a little bit more testing on this one. I'll come back and talk a little bit about it next week because I'm very curious to see what I can get out of it and very, very curious to see what the thermals look like because I feel like I can't tell if it's thermally slowing down or it's just a slower processor than some of the other models I've seen. So,
well, yeah, I'm with you on the thermal line of thought because they go to such extremes to make these as thin as possible. And then even if you have a dual fan setup, which if that has, that's great for a laptop of that size. And I've seen that in other Lenovo models, but if they're tailoring the fan profile to reduce noise output and they can update it in firmware to maybe, you know, to sacrifice a few decibels for better performance, because those processors, they live and die by their thermal envelope. And, you know, you can tweak quite a bit in the way of performance just by increasing the fan RPMs. So that 4.6 gigahertz max, because that is actually the same exact processor that's in this is the HP Spectre X360, and it has that same Core i7 processor in it that's in that IdeaPad, and I haven't done like extensive testing with this. This is something they sent with the H10 Optane drive. But it certainly lives a lot closer to the 1.8 gigahertz speed most of the time than anywhere close to that 4.6 single core boost. So one of the things you mentioned about that, I wanted to quickly pick your brain about, like the trackpad, you said it was one of the best you've used. I know that for Tech Thing, just a short time ago, you went through the Lenovo Y7000 gaming laptop, right?
I did not get a whole bunch of hands-on time with the Y7000 because Shannon reviewed that one.
Gotcha, right.
But okay. I'm not going to say at this, you know, it feels good. I'm like looking around to reach for a laptop to hold up. At this point,
my point in bringing that up was that the Y7000, even though it's kind of, you know, a mid-range kind of the laptop you're going to find at a Costco store on sale,
right?
The trackpad was really, really good. And I'm a huge trackpad snob, and I sneer at trackpads. The trackpad in front of me on this Acer laptop is terrible, and it's not responsive, and I don't feel like there's too much friction as I try to move around on the keyboard or the trackpad surface. And this little HP, I went through and kind of, you know, it evaluated it, and the trackpad is okay. It's a little too narrow. It's narrow and wide. Lenovo has been getting better and better with trackpads. Going back to my first ThinkPad Yoga from when that came out, I got that in like 2014, and that had a small trackpad, but it was very good. And they've been getting bigger, more Apple-like with the large, smooth, glassy surfaces. So, you know, if the keyboard feels good and it has a great trackpad and the screen is good, we start to get into this world where if they can figure out the exact profile to enable a little bit higher CPU frequencies, thermal management stuff, they can have a really compelling alternative to a MacBook even at the same price point. Because $1,800 is expensive, but $1,800 is still, I haven't spec'd one out, but a 1 terabyte upgrade on a 13.3-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar is probably around $2,000 for that machine. So
a non-trivial amount. I should point out, when I'm looking at a premium a laptop, you know, Dell XPS, some of the high-end HP stuff, Lenovo, you know, anybody else at this point, I expect the trackpad to be fairly flawless in terms of how it functions. So I, you know, if I don't notice anything that pisses me off, I'm usually pretty happy at this point. You know, and I got to say, if you're spending, you know, even $1,000, you know, much less, you know, $1,500 or $2,000 for a laptop, you should have no complaints. You know, Lenovo has always been really, really good with keyboards and input devices. You know, especially on the ThinkPad lineup, and I think they've done their best on to keep the quality up at the low end. Because, you know, as you know, Shannon had bought a Razer gaming laptop to use for video editing when she was traveling for events and stuff like CES, and you know, she went through three of those because the trackpad died twice. You know, and there's few things that'll really piss off a laptop user faster than having a keyboard or a trackpad with issues. you know, it seems kind of obvious, but it's amazing how often that, you know, whatever they throw in there is good enough. They don't really think about it because they're too busy thinking about the thermals or they're too busy thinking about the screen. It's nice when companies make an effort and give you a decent functioning keyboard and trackpad. It should be, I think, mandatory. But as you have noted, sir, sometimes it is unfortunately lacking. Little quick heads up for everybody out there. I know a lot of you use Dells. I've got a Dell XPS 13 about 6 feet to my right now. Dell Support Assist Utility has a vulnerability, and you should update that if you haven't already. The update came out April 23rd, but we're talking about hackers being able to run remote hijacks and execute code with admin privileges, which is what we people, I should say not we, but people in the security world refer to as really bad. It's about the last thing you want people to be able to do remotely. Patch was released, like I said, April 23rd. Make sure you have it. Nice summary of what's going on up at ZDNet, but you're looking for CVE 2019-3719 in terms of what's going on with the vulnerability. So I should point out the attacker does need to be on the same network to do the ARP spoofing and the DNS spoofing, but you know, it's always amazing how easy it is to get access to a network if you really want to. And, you know, the place this gets really scary is if you were in a large enterprise organization and you have thousands of these machines scattered around the world. So heads up, update your Dell Support Assist Utility, or if you're running a fleet of machines, make sure they have updated Support Assist Utilities, lest you become surprised, terrified, and your nerve is racked. Speaking of securing your lifestyle, this episode of the Speaking Computer Hardware is brought to you by Helm. Helm created a personal server. The really simple concept. We're going to give you a box. It's not really a box. It's a triangle thing. And inside that triangle is your online identity, your email, your calendars, your contacts, your files, your photos, not on Google servers, not on Yahoo's servers, not on your ISP server, on the Helm device inside your home. Your most critical information, it gets stored on massive corporate servers outside your home. Does that make you a little nervous about hacking? Or, if, you know, what are they doing with that data? Is it really secure? So if you, the idea is really simple. You connect Helm to your home network, and they're going to give you the best privacy and security that they can, right? Because your information, your data, your life is no longer in the cloud. It's actually in your house. How nice does that sound? Michael Lee, a world-renowned expert in privacy and security and also a recent Helm customer, wrote an article on April 30th for The Intercept on how amazing Helm is and how it works. You can go to TheIntercept.com to read the article. You know, Leo and I sat down with the Helm people before, you know, we took this campaign and had a really intense discussion about what was going on, how they were securing it, what their goals were. And it's pretty impressive, right? You can manage unlimited domains, email accounts, aliases. You can set up multiple users from a single device. Setup's quick. Takes like 5 minutes. DMARC, SPF, DKIM, email authentication. And, you know, full disk encryption. Keys are managed by a secure enclave. The boot's secured. TLS encryption with certificates for your domain from Let's Encrypt. Proximity-based two-factor authentication through the Helm app. So it makes it harder for people to try to spoof the device. Offsite backups are encrypted, and you know they require your unique, your private security key to access. They're doing their best to kind of lock down everything and make it secure. Now, they just added a new service to their personal servers, Helm Files, powered by Nextcloud. And with Helm Files, you get file sync, file sharing, photo backup. You can upload, you can view, you can share your files and photos securely. So you finally have a powerful private alternative to Google Drive and Dropbox. Privacy is a right, not a setting. Protect what matters with Helm. For a limited time, save $50 off the Helm personal server by visiting thehelm.com/twitch. Due to strong demand, Helm is currently sold out, but don't worry, they're accepting deposits, so you'll be among the first to get yours when they're back in stock. That's thehelm.com/TWICH. We want to thank the Helm for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, my goodness. Are you excited about the new ThinkPads that Lenovo's dropping that are going to be running AMD Ryzen Pro? Is this exciting to you, sir?
Well, I haven't used one yet or seen battery life and stuff. That's really my only concern. And that could be just an old prejudice about AMD parts and battery life and that sort of thing. Right. But we've talked about on this podcast how Intel gets really good battery life, and it's by clocking things down, especially with the increase in core counts with the 8th and 9th gen stuff. So I am very interested. I would like to get my hands on one of these and test it out, because a number of these ThinkPads, the T495, T495S, X395, are going to be featuring the 2nd gen Ryzen Pro Mobile parts. So CPUs, APUs, and it's 2nd gen. So by this summer, we're going to be all about 3rd gen Ryzen stuff. But right, they've been a bit behind with mobile parts. But I can't blame them, because they're not in wide use. So if we start to see more manufacturers adopting these platforms, and this is another one of those side effects of what we talked about in previous weeks, where either Intel does or does not have a chip shortage problem, which I keep on getting conflicting reports on this about every month. Mm-hmm. And they apparently do, or at least did, to the extent that AMD got some wins. And there are several products that will be coming out leading up to laptop season and, you know, the big back to school push and all of that, that are going to be AMD powered instead of Intel. So,
right.
I can't wait to see the first reviews or get hands on with one of these and see how they perform, but it's going to be, you know, a ThinkPad. It's going to have the same input, same screen. It's just whether these Ryzen parts are going to deliver the same kind of performance and battery life. But pricing is going to be attractive, I hope. Like, I'm looking at, it says starting at 939, starting at 1089. So for higher end ThinkPads, it's not bad at all. We're looking at stuff that usually costs like $1,100, $1,200 and up. So
that sounds excited. Or at least
could be curious. Excited. Yeah.
Yes. We wait with bated breath.
Yes.
I'm not waiting with bated breath, but I am kind of curious. I love things that say world's fastest. They make us happy. AMD, Cray, working together for the Department of Energy. They're going to build by 2021 for Oak Ridge the world's fastest supercomputer. Frontier. If you're watching the video, you can see the giant logo across the bank of server enclosures. Oak Ridge National Laboratory and the Department of Energy and Cray and AMD are presenting Frontier. Woo! Ooh. Cue lights and run the pyro.
I like how we're beyond teraflops now, just with
exaflops.
The raw compute power of this. Yeah, 1.5 exaflops.
So
we're in the quintillions of computations per second now.
Yeah. And if you don't know what a quintillion is, that's a one with 18 zeros behind it. So, and then of course there's the sort of relative scale. AMD told The Verge that Frontier will have, quote, as much processing power as the next 160 fastest supercomputers combined. You know, bandwidth, you know, it's fun when they put like sort of non-relative numbers, but 24 million times the bandwidth of the average home internet connection, capable of processing 100,000 HD movies in a second. You know, it's also a 7,300, you know, that it's going to take up a 7,300 square foot room, i.e. two basketball courts, and have 90 miles of cabling. Yeah, I always love the part where they take really random comparisons to make it sound super huge. It is pretty super huge, but you know, this is DOE is also working on the supercomputer Aurora. China is building an exascale supercomputer they expect to have running up in 2020. You know, it's also interesting that China is ahead of the U.S. in terms of supercomputer volume, but this is like a $600 million contract for AMD. And I'm kind of really curious to see, you know, what parts go into it, how they're put together, because there was nada in terms of what the silicon was going to be, you know, what kind of customizations were being made, how it was being tied together. It's exciting. I'm always kind of curious, you know, you're basically talking about like, oh, let's, you know, let's do weather simulations, you know, on a global scale, or they're doing, you know, nuclear simulations or stuff, but it's always exciting. I thought this was pretty cool. Microsoft's Power Toys, which is something that we were talking about, one of the Power Toys, Sync Toy, a few weeks ago on Tech Thing. Jim over at PC Pro wrote up that Power Toys has become an open source Windows 10 utility.
Yeah. Get it over at GitHub. And
I'm fascinated.
I know this goes all the way back to Windows 95 because I've read that. I never used it in that era. I started with Windows XP and I was using Tweak UI and doing things like quickly and easily changing like the login screen type or I remember altering my millisecond show delay for the start menu. Because if you remember, Windows XP had kind of a long delay like navigating the start, but just stuff like that, that became just trivially easy with a GUI environment like that. And there, like you mentioned, Sync Toy, that's a valid utility today. And it's got to be over a decade old at this point. So just having all this stuff available again is great. The fact that it's open source and you can just, I haven't looked at the project yet. Jim was talking about it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And someone else has done the work. That's great.
Yay. Hey, you got hands-on with Silverstone's the Argon series. That's a low-profile CPU cooler. How did that work out? You basically said it's a worthy substitute for the stock cooler. Was the performance better than the stock cooler or merely similar to?
Yeah, it's better. The sad thing is that they're my favorite low-profile cooler, which in this there's different subsets of low-profile. There's like the 78-millimeter stuff, the 58, 59. And then this is at 47 millimeters, which just so happens to be the exact height of an Intel stock cooler. So if you're comparing Intel stock cooler replacements, the best one that I had personally tested was from CryoRig, which is their C7. And then, of course, I find out that the C7 is impossible to find. There are zero results on PC Part Picker. Anything I can find on Amazon is like outrageously inflated, you know, $100-ish dollar listings for what was, I think, a $39 part at I reviewed it back in 2016. So Silverstone released fairly recently this product, which is their Argon Series AR11, same 47 millimeter height. It's using a 92 millimeter fan. And it is kind of like, in design, it's kind of like taking that Hyper 212 Evo and squishing it down to 47 millimeters because you have the four direct heat pipes, just like the Hyper 212 Evo. And I thought that was kind of a novel thing. You have four heat pipes and a 47 millimeter cooler. In actual practice, it could use a little bit of milling. Like it could be flatter. You're not going to get absolutely perfect contact with all four heat pipes unless you're using a lot of thermal paste. And I'm guessing it's like sample specific how flat it is. So I think that kind of impaired its ability to cool because it ended up not beating out the CryoRig, but it doesn't really matter if you can't get the CryoRig because it's significantly better than Intel's solution. Like Intel stock cooler can technically cool a Core i7 if your only concern is not hitting the T-junction 100C temperature. I could run, which I did hit, of course, with my Core i7 7700K, which is the hottest Core i7 I've ever tested until the 9900K. Right. But using a reasonable, like a rational low-profile CPU cooler or CPU choice, which is I just threw in a Core i3 8100, which is a quad core, basically replaced the 7th gen Core i5s because they went to – the i3s went to quad core and the i5s went to hex core. So that, you know, it's keeping it very cool, completely reasonable temperature ranges, like max, you know, under 30C above ambient, like no problem at all. The CryoRig, you know, if you can find one, is still a little bit better than that. But Intel stock cooler, 36 degrees. So you're dropping almost 7 degrees. But still, I mean, a 65 watt part like that, which is actually running, I think it's more like 54 watts, is just no problem with any of these coolers. And Intel stock cooler is actually really quiet, the quietest of the bunch. So when I move up to an unrealistic kind of, you know, just punishing thermal load with the Core i7, then you see the Intel stock cooler is like 83. That's only because like it was hitting T-junction and it was throttling at that point.
Right.
The AR11 way down, 63.7 was the highest. And I'm talking like all cores being pushed using X264 benchmark, like the second pass, all cores at 100%. And, you know, that C7, kind of a mystical figure now, it just a little bit better performance than that. But still, I mean, you're getting really close to a cooler you can no longer even buy, which was, you know, outperformed everything else in its size. And this thing sells for, I think it's $37.99 on Amazon. So it's not bad. The only issue I had with it was noise. And if you really push this thing to its full 3,000 RPMs, it is rather loud. It's a 15 millimeter thick, low profile fan that can spin a little over 3,000 RPMs. So at 92 millimeters, this is not quiet. And it's just, there's no way around that. It was very quiet with the Core i3 and very loud with the Core i7. So maybe a Core i5 is the right mix. Like tailor your own fan profile. But or find another 92 millimeter fan that's a little bit quieter. But an interesting idea. I think that maybe the next revision of it, if it had like a solid milled base for better contact, maybe make a premium version of this with a quieter fan. But when people look at low profile coolers, like the number one result on Amazon every time I look is always that same Noctua that's 37 millimeters high. It's the NH, what is it? Something 9i that it's like a $40 low profile 37 millimeter solution.
This NHL 9i?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The one that everybody has. Yes. And so that does a really good job, but it's, I was just thinking, what can you do with that extra 10 millimeters? Like, how much better will the cooling performance be? But as you can see from Patrick's video here, that is a really, really well made cooler with a very, very flat base. So you get very it's good hefty. Contact with the CPU.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you look at their kind of listings and the specs for this, they're iffy on some. They don't have any AMD processors listed on their compatibility guide. They're all Intel ones. And their sort of comfort level with 95, like they cap it at 95 watt TDP, and some 95 watt TDP models, they're less comfortable than others, or they advise you have good case ventilation and a good fan. You know, but this is a massive hunk of metal. Plus, there's a couple heat pipes inside of here. So they're working pretty hard to kind of get the heat outside of your or off of your CPU and into your case where it can go outside. But I mean, it also amazes me how hefty that damn thing is. It's like 420 grams, which somehow feels, you know, and it's all copper, right? The base and the heat pipes are copper. The cooling fins are aluminum. It has some heft. I have an 1800X I'm going to put underneath it, which probably will be a mistake, but it'll be fun playing around with that.
They have an AMD version. I actually have the AMD version that I inherited, but I have not been brave enough to install it on any of those yet.
Well, you know what? I'll try to break it, and then we can talk afterwards.
Yeah.
You know. You'll get this frantic text message. I killed it! Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we got to wrap it up because something exciting is happening at the Twit Cottage, or I should say the Twit facility in the near future, and i.e. several minutes from now. So we got to wrap everything up and make sure all of our stuff is done so they can edit this and post it to you. So with that, you've been listening to Twitch. Not Twit. Well, a Twit show called Twitch, TWICH, This Week in Computer Hardware. He's Sebastian Peek. I'm Patrick Norton. You can find him at PC Purr. You can find me at TechThing or AVXL. And we invite you to visit all of our websites, download all the shows. And if you haven't, please subscribe to This Week in Computer Hardware at twit.tv/Twitch. And with that, I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peek.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.